a new American moment. Discuss today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump says we're living in a new American moment, but how new?
There's not a huge amount that distinguishes it from the late Obama years, except the nature of President Trump's rhetoric.
We'll hear a lot of different views on that today, including from a Latina in Arizona who agrees with Trump on immigration.
We have very good people coming in. I'm a good immigrant, and I have many good friends from many countries who have come here and are good elements for society. But at the same time, we have bad apples.
And from a former gang member who thinks rehabilitation is better than deportation.
People don't see that we're human and that we could change. And we have parents, we have family, we have children.
So what is this new American moment? That's ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World.
This, in fact, is our new American moment. There has never been a better time to start living the American dream.
A new American moment. It implies there was an old American moment, and last night President Trump seemed to bid it farewell. But what this so-called new American moment means, well, that depends on your point of view. So throughout the show today, we're asking our guests for their thoughts, starting with someone who really liked what she heard in Trump's State of the Union.
For me, the new American moment is a moment that is more aware of everybody and more aware of the needs of every citizen of this country, regardless if they are an immigrant or not, regardless if they were born here or not. And to me, that was very important and very special.
Monica Yellen is an Arizona Republican and a member of the group Latinas for Trump. She's also a naturalized citizen, originally from Colombia. And I wanted to hear her thoughts about the president's plan to tighten legal immigration.
You know what? I understand where he comes from. We have very good people coming in. I'm a good immigrant, and I have many good friends from many countries who have come here and are good elements for society. But at the same time, we have bad apples. It only takes one person that can cause a bad attack to everybody else. And I agree with what he's saying. We need to safeguard the country, and we need to be careful with who is coming in.
I mean, some critics would say your position is hypocritical, that it amounts to pulling up the drawbridge.
I don't think my position is hypocritical. I think I'm very familiar with immigration processes, and I agree with bringing immigrants to this country who contribute to society. And Trump agrees too. But again, we have to do better. We have to screen better because we have terrorist attacks and we have people that come here and are abusing the system.
Do you agree with the way Donald Trump has framed immigration? I mean, we even saw, glimmers of that last night during the State of the Union where, you know, he focuses on immigrants who have killed people or, you know, he's focusing on the bad apples. He's focusing on Mexicans as, you know, criminals and drug dealers. He said that on the first day of his campaign.
Well, this is not what people think. He's not focusing on bad people. What Donald Trump is doing is he's making examples. His examples are examples of why we have to safeguard the country. It's not that he's focusing on them. Again, he says there are very good people coming to this country and we value them. But at the same time, we have to safeguard the country. When I was a Colombian citizen and I only have a Colombian passport, you have no idea how many issues I had all over the country. Did I go around saying, oh, they are being racist, they are judging me? No. Every country has the right to safeguard their borders, and I completely agree with this country safeguarding the country.
Do you really believe Donald Trump sees all people equally, especially after he referred disparagingly to Salvadorans and Haitians and Africans?
Well, you know what? You weren't there, and I wasn't there either. So we really don't know how exactly that conversation went. We don't know exactly what he said. But let's say that he really did say that. He wasn't lying, and he wasn't wrong. We understand that everybody who comes to this country, especially from third world countries, we understand those countries are not in the best shape. Even my own country, I love Colombia, but you know what? I have a much better life here than if I was living there. So I'm very grateful for the United States. So I don't think Donald Trump sees people, he sees everybody equally, but he is right about what he says. He wants quality and he wants to protect the borders and he wants equality. And this is what my problem is. If all of us fight equally for veterans, for the disabled, for children, for everybody who lives in the United States, whether they are immigrants or not, but people seem to focus only on certain group of people, but they don't focus on anything else. And that's my problem. We need to fight equally for everybody who lives here.
Monica, where would you like to see the immigration debate play out from here, in Congress specifically?
I believe that Congress needs to get their act together and they need to make a solution, because what the problem I see is that everybody's fighting for political victories instead of thinking and fighting about people. My heart goes to those children who were brought here by their parents, because I believe that I don't have a problem with people having a chance to stay in this country who have contributed to society.
So your priority is getting a deal for DACA. You see that as important and you want that to happen.
I think it's very important that a deal is done, and the Congress needs to put their act together. Both Republicans and Democrats should act together, definitely.
So just on your argument that we need to protect people, why not give people, if you believe we should protect them, why not give them at least some path to citizenship instead of, you know, sending them back to places where, as we'll hear in the show today, from a Syrian, they might get killed?
Well, Donald Trump never said, oh, I don't want to give citizenship to anybody. So I agree with giving citizenship to people, but we have to be fair. And I'm sorry for those people who are refugees and for those people who come here because they have a really, really bad life there. And I'm very sorry for them and I want to help them. But we have to help everybody equally and we have to think of our country first.
Monica, do you believe in the idea that America is defined by its immigrants?
America is defined by its immigrants. It's true. But it's defined by the good immigrants and the good people of the country. And that's what we're looking for. We just want equality. And guess what? People need to stop these arguments that America, that the Trump administration is racist, that he wants to control immigration and make America white. Let's stop being hypocrites and let's look at the policies of migration around the world. Look at Poland, look at Hungary, look at Germany, look at the European Union. So what Trump is saying is not outrageous. He's right. And all the other countries practice the same thing.
Monica Yellen, a member of Latinas for Trump and an Arizona GOP member at large. Really great to hear your thoughts. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for your time.
It really speaks loud to where America is right now in regards to racial motivated policies. We believe that we're still living in a place where there's a lot of racism and it's institutionalized racism.
That's how Alex Sanchez sees Trump's new American moment. He was listening carefully to the president last night, especially when the president spoke about the gang MS-13 and the violence it had inflicted on two families that Trump had invited to the gallery. Alex Sanchez is a former MS-13 member based in Los Angeles. He also founded the U.S. chapter of the group's Homies Unidos. It works to get young men and women out of gangs and into productive roles in their communities. I asked Sanchez what led him to join MS-13.
Well, I was a young man, immigrant youth that was fleeing the war in El Salvador. I had been exposed to the violence, and I came here and I was not welcomed. I was made fun of. I was a 7-year-old boy, and I was targeted by different ethnic groups and other people because of my accent and the lack of understanding the language. So obviously you are full of resentment, especially when you have been left behind. In my case, for 5 years with my little brother. My little brother was a year and a half when he was left behind. I was 3 years old. So by the time we came and met our parents, they were aliens to me. They were not somebody that we knew. They were individuals that just call ourselves parents, but we did not have a relationship with them. And it was difficult to build that relation because the family unity was already broken. My mother did not want to leave me behind. She left us because she did not have a choice. And her choice to survive, to be there for us, even from afar, you know, really separated us in ways in which we cannot be remediable. We cannot fix it. And that's where I started looking for solutions in the block. I started looking for solutions in the streets. And there was no community centers. There was no programs available, not even in school or in the community, that could really address my issues as an immigrant young man in this community where when I walked out, I saw violence. I saw alcoholism. I saw homelessness. You know, I was afraid all the time. I needed I needed to feel safe. And the gang provided that to me. And that's what's still happening now.
Mm. Let's listen to President Trump last night talking about his solutions.
Tonight, I am calling on Congress to finally close the deadly loopholes that have allowed MS-13 and other criminal gangs to break into our country. We have proposed new legislation that will fix our immigration laws and support our ICE and Border Patrol agents. These are great people. These are great, great people that work so hard in the midst of such danger so that this can never happen again.
Alex Sanchez, what do you make of the president's proposal, and where do you see kind of any opportunities that you were talking about, opportunities that wouldn't make gangs a viable path for young people?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that these gangs were created in the United States and continue to exist within that because there hasn't been a straight, smart strategy to address the problem, because it's not really affecting white society. It's affecting communities of color. And as long as we continue to look at this as a criminal element instead of a social issue in our communities and a health issue in our communities, we will continue to have gangs and continue to build policies that have all failed. Gangs did not exist in El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras prior to the deportation. Mass deportation of gang members as a solution is what has created this now that we have in an international level.
So, Alex, I know we caught you on a pretty busy day. You're grabbing lunch in the middle of prison visits. Tell us about those and why you're doing them.
We're visiting 16 prisons here in California and visiting immigrants that will most likely be deported back to their country of origin in Central America. Most of these individuals are lifers that done a lot of time, 20, 30 years at times. Many of these individuals, they don't have a place to go to. They don't have a home. They don't have work. They don't have services. So with a partner organization called ASAPLE in El Salvador, the lady Elisa Jurado comes here, visit them. We accompany her. We work with the families in Los Angeles, and we visit them so she could get information and visit their loved ones or extended family members in their country of origin, in which they will be able to provide housing, employment, and other services that are available to them in the community. This is smart move that should be funded, but we don't get one dime from government because we're creating reentry plans for people that are being deported. They're going to have a place to go to, but mass deportation does not provide that. Mass deportation sends individuals back to their country, and they're sitting in the airport like I did in 1994 when I was deported, with a paper with an address that I didn't know how to get to. No employment, no housing, no family. What do you do? What do you do then? What do you do at the airport? How do you even get home to what you think you knew what it was, which has changed? We just had a young man that got deported, 21-year-old man, got deported to Mexico. We helped out. He was in our program. We weren't able to help him out, get released from immigration. And the depression of being sent back to a country that was foreign to him, this individual this Saturday committed suicide. Yeah. Now we're trying to get him back here so he can be buried next to his family. This is the tragedies of deportation that people don't see. They look at us as criminals. People don't see that we're human and that we could change. And we have parents, we have family, we have children. We're human.
Alex Sanchez, a former gang member and founder of the U.S. chapter of Homies Unidos, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Coming up on the show, why Olympic ice hockey is going to look a lot different this year on the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Let's get back to this idea of a new American moment. In his first State of the Union last night, Trump said of this moment, there has never been a better time to start living the American dream. Susan Glasser is chief international affairs columnist with Politico. Whether you like it or not, I mean, he's right. I mean, this is a new and perhaps unique moment in American history.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I think some of the fact checkers have made a pretty credible case that there's not a huge amount that distinguishes it from the late Obama years, except the nature of President Trump's rhetoric. But certainly as a president, he's different than anyone we've had before.
I suspect you see a difference between the old American moment and what he's calling the new American moment. How would you describe both of those?
Well, look, I mean, it's very good politics, whatever else it is, to have made your inaugural speech a description of basically an American dystopia, a hellscape we remember his famous American Carnage line, right. Because then a year later, you can come and declare victory over the carnage, even though the fundamentals of the economy are actually quite similar.
So in the international context, I mean, I kind of see two parts to this. The moment where America under Trump seems determined to detach itself from the rest of the world, and there's how that is being seen by other countries and what that could spell for U.S. standing in the world. So first of all, when Trump says America first does not mean America alone, you quoted on Twitter the German foreign minister saying, China filling the void, worldwide only nation with a real geopolitical strategy. Can Trump have it both ways?
Well, I think these are contradictory impulses that still exist in his foreign policy 1 year in. And so on the one hand, you have this very nationalist rhetoric of America first. And, you know, whether it's America alone or not, it's certainly a version of foreign policy that emphasizes unilateral action or, you know, direct country to country relations rather than the multilateral alliances, institutions, treaties that have really been the staple of other presidents' leadership in both parties, I should add. So you have that strand and then a contradictory strand, which is Trump's desire to show that he is a strong leader, projecting force and the American way onto the world stage. And there, some of his actions have been quite interesting. He has not withdrawn the United States from some of its long-running commitments or conflicts. But in fact, in many ways, a surprising element of the last year is that he's really empowered the U.S. military, and they are not only still embroiled in all of the conflicts they were a year ago, but he has increased, in many cases, resources.
Secondly, this statement that U.S. standing, and I'm pretty sure I heard this right, he said that the U.S. standing in the world has grown. And we've spoken a number of times about U.S. standing in the world slipping under Trump. But do you see where U.S. standing has grown in the last year?
Look, you know, Donald Trump is not one to let the facts stand in the way of an applause line in his speech. And the numbers are overwhelming in that countries around the world have changed their views of the United States for the worse, dramatically in most cases, in particular in the countries that have been our closest allies and partners historically. The rare exceptions where Trump seems to be looked more favorably and the United States more favorably than in the past under President Obama are countries like Russia and China. So, you know, that is a claim that doesn't really hold water, but it can mean whatever he wants it to mean. And in Trump's view and what he's selling the American electorate, whether or not they're buying it, but what he's selling the American electorate is the idea that he's a strong leader and that people, even if they don't love it, admire and will follow strength.
I mean, the countries that say we're not sure about the U.S. anymore, those are official statements. And I'm wondering if there are voices we're missing. There are leaders in Europe that are taking cues from him. And I was following a thread among some Nigerian writers recently after his alleged S-hole comment. And you know, this one person said in Nigeria, there are a lot of people who respect Trump because he has business expertise. So what is the reality of respect for the U.S. in this new American moment?
Well, look, I mean, you know, global leadership is not actually a popularity contest, right? And we should say that, you know, these are relevant findings. They've been pretty consistent from the Pew Research Center, from Gallup, which are the most respected independent pollsters who do this sort of thing. The conclusions are overwhelming that there's been a negative, very strong negative trend in how the rest of the world views the United States and specifically its president. And I don't think that's under much dispute. Now, does that mean that he, politically speaking, is howled? Yes and no, right? You know, Ronald Reagan was dramatically unpopular in Western Europe at the height of the end of the Cold War when he was talking tough about the Soviet Union, right? You know, there have been periods when we've certainly had American presidents who were unpopular, even in places where our traditional allies operated. However, generally, we've had strong government-to-government relations in that period. And I do think you cited, you know, my citation of Sigmar Gabriel, the German foreign minister. Mm. That's where there's a real issue. Donald Trump is not popular with their publics, and by all accounts, he's not super popular with their leaders either when it comes to our traditional allies in Western Europe.
Have you heard or read anything instructive from overseas today about this new American moment?
You know, I think that the bottom line is that the rest of the world is paying extraordinarily close attention to Donald Trump. And frankly, they're confused. they don't really know. We're confused, right? Here we are, and we spend, you know, full time, and I'm here in Washington trying to understand, well, what is Donald Trump's foreign policy? Well, the rest of the world is intensely interested in that fact and trying to figure it out and read the tea leaves from thousands of miles away. And I think that there's enormous confusion. Just yesterday, I was at an event here in Washington, and a Chinese journalist asked me basically that very question. He said, well, which Trump is it? And, you know, how are we supposed to make North Korea policy if we don't understand which policy you have? And I don't think that the speech last night really answered that in any kind of clear cut way.
Do you have kids, and do you have to explain this new American moment to them?
You know, I have a 13-year-old son who is extremely interested in politics. And sometimes he even, you know, tells me about news events first because he's got the news alert set on his phone. However, I've noticed a real Trump fatigue setting in, you know, with him. And for example, he did not want to watch the speech.
I was going to ask, did he watch the speech?
No, but, you know, he has a very pronounced view of President Trump. And, you know, so perhaps that was for the best.
We'll leave it there. Susan Glasser with Politico. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And here's one more take on the new American moment.
Well, I didn't actually watch the State of the Union last night. I was sleeping.
Journalist Iona Craig follows events in Yemen for us.
But I suppose, what does that look like globally? And a lot of people in the Middle East are probably still pretty unclear of what the Trump administration's main aims are within the region. Of course, they've played a loss on the influence of Saudi Arabia in the major power struggle that is playing out between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and could potentially have a huge influence on that. But yes, what Trump's foreign policy is unclear now, I think, as it was probably 12 months ago.
We'll hear more from Iona on tomorrow's show. She'll tell us about the latest in the civil war in Yemen and about America's involvement in that conflict. I'm Marco Werman. Amr fled the war in Syria. Now he's one of thousands of Syrians living here under temporary protected status. And he's worried he might get sent back.
Usually, like, I'm a software engineer. I always have plan B. But now I'm running out of solutions. I'm just trying to like, plan day by day.
His story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The Cleveland Indians are ditching Chief Wahoo. That'd be the team's mascot, which has been denounced by many people, both native and non-native, as a racist caricature. It's been the team mascot since 1947, but now Major League Baseball says it's not appropriate on the field, and the logo will be removed from all team uniforms next year. Jacqueline Keeler is a reporter who created the hashtag NotYourMascot back in 2014. She was born in Cleveland, and the city plays an important role in her own family's history.
My parents met in Cleveland. My mother is Navajo, and my father is Yankton Sioux. And there was a policy in the 1950s and 60s and into the 70s passed by Congress to terminate tribes and to relocate the population to relocation centers, and Cleveland was one of those centers. There are no reservations in Ohio, and the Revolutionary War was partly fought to gain access to the Ohio Valley. You know, they wanted the farmland, so the Shawnee and Tecumseh were absolutely removed from that state. So when my parents lived there in Cleveland, there were about 20,000 young Native people there, and that was the first time in quite a long time that Native people were there in any numbers, and that's when they began organizing to get rid of the mascot.
So what does removing this logo mean to you? What have you heard from other Native people in the Cleveland area?
I'm really grateful that it's happening finally. It's been three generations of my family protesting against this pretty grotesque caricature of Native people, which studies have shown that mascots definitely change the way people view other ethnic groups, not just Native people. And so the act of mascotting someone is a violent act. It's a taking. And Cleveland, Ohio is a beautiful city and is ethnically diverse. I think that if Cleveland wants to remake itself, it does need to come together and have a real conversation.
The team owner of the Cleveland Indians had previously said that they don't really see eye to eye with the league on this issue and that fans have an attachment to Chief Wahoo. So a few years ago, you went to a Cleveland Indians game and talked to fans. What did you hear from them? And did you find that people in Cleveland know about the city's history as a relocation center set up by the Bureau of Indian Affairs?
No. And when I wrote about it in Salon in 2014, many people from Cleveland contacted me and they had no idea what happened there or even the history of why Ohio doesn't have any Indians. And I don't think that Chief Wahoo is teaching that to them. They're celebrating Indians in a vacuum.
You started, as I said, the hashtag NotYourMascot in 2014, and there was at the time a national conversation going on about sports teams and mascots like the Washington Redskins and the Cleveland Indians. Does it surprise you that this is the first official change you've seen since then?
You know, I think the mascot issue has always surprised me. I think there is something psychological about the attachment. It's not logical. I mean, University of Emory found that all these teams actually lose money from having a native mascot. They looked at a data set from college teams that had given up their native mascot, and they found that 2 years later, they had greater participation by their audience. I think they estimated that Cleveland was losing close to $2 million a year because of their association with that mascot.
That's
so
incredible.
It's not logical. It's something else. So that's why I think it's been so difficult to address.
Well, that's interesting because the Cleveland Indians logo will be removed from players' uniforms, but the team is still going to be selling merch with Chief Wahoo so they can keep the trademark, and the name of the team is staying the same. Is this progress?
You know, I think it is progress. I mean, this is the first time we've gotten any franchise to actually admit in any way that there's an issue with the stereotyping of Native people for profit. The main issue is that Native people are not in control of the use of our identity. There's not a proliferation of representations of Native people in the media. You don't see TV shows with modern Native families and their lives depicted on television. And so Americans are not knowledgeable about Native people in a meaningful way. People often try to compare that to the Vikings. And I always say, you know, if that was the only way that white men were portrayed, whenever you saw a white man, it was just as a Viking. And when you met him, the first thing you would say is, where's your longboat? Where's your horns, right? Because that's your only context of understanding him. Then that would be the same situation. But that is actually our situation.
Yeah, so you see the end of Chief Wahoo as progress. I'm just curious to know how you square that with Donald Trump and the State of the Union address last night, speaking of this new American moment. How did you hear that?
I really do see this as a continuation of what we saw with the Revolutionary War, which is the ideology of colonization, you know, the colonial mindset. What makes Indigenous people special is our relationship to the land and the responsibility we have to the land. And we are constantly at odds with a colonial impulse, which is about profitability of the land and the generation of personal wealth. And so certainly I see the American moment that Trump is discussing is this recommitment to colonialism and to profitability.
Jacqueline Keeler, a reporter and Cleveland native, she created the hashtag NotYourMascot back in 2014. Jacqueline, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Winter Olympics are just 9 days away, and for those of you tuning into men's ice hockey, it's going to look a bit different because the Stars are gone. For the first time since 1994, the National Hockey League won't be going on hiatus and allowing its players to represent their nations. And that has Team USA as well as Team Canada and others sending lineups of largely unknowns. The World's Jason Margolis has more.
A few months ago, the Olympics weren't even on Ryan Donato's radar. We sat in the stands and watched his team, Harvard Hockey, warm up for practice. Donato expected to spend February attending classes and skating for Harvard. Then the hockey world shifted, and Donato allowed himself to dream a little bit.
When I found out the NHL guys weren't going, I definitely thought it was a possibility, but I didn't want to read too much into it because I tend to get myself too excited about those kind of things. And I think,
in December, he got the call. So he had to ask his professors for a leave of absence.
I think it was probably the most exciting thing of my career so far, obviously. I'm just a college hockey player right now, so I think having that opportunity to represent my country is something that I'll cherish.
The U.S. Olympic men's hockey team is a mix of four college players and guys playing in the Swiss, Swedish, German, and Russian leagues. For Kevin Greenstein, the roster is a disappointment. He's editor-in-chief of Inside Hockey, an online magazine.
This, to me, is kind of like if a random minor league was showing some hockey games on television in the middle of the night, and you turn it on, it's like, maybe I'll watch it, maybe I won't.
But hold on. Yes, many hockey fans are disappointed that the NHL isn't freeing up its players. But the Olympic viewing audience may not mind so much. Most of us were rooting for a flag or an athlete with a compelling storyline. Consider Jordan Greenway, a junior psychology major at Boston University. Ask Greenway how old he is.
20. Think about that for a second.
When do you turn 21?
February 16th. So I'll be over in South Korea for it.
Greenway has a compelling story. He'll be the first black Olympic hockey player skating for Team USA, men's or women's.
I didn't know, honestly, until I found out, like, when I was over at the Winter Classic. But yeah, it's great, you know, just being able to kind of, I guess, break a barrier that hasn't been broken before and hopefully allowing kids who are younger than I am to try and do the same things. You know, I think hockey's more of a, you know, more white people play than, you know, black people. So, you know, I think hopefully I can just inspire and motivate kids to, you know, go out and do something different and kind of follow what I've done, you know.
And here's another compelling storyline, Russia. Russia is the heavy favorite to win gold in South Korea, or they were until Russia got banned from the Olympics for widespread systematic doping. Hundreds of Russian athletes will still be going to South Korea. They just won't be competing under the Russian flag. It's confusing, but now the, quote, Olympic athletes from Russia competing under the Olympic flag are the favorites to win gold. Many of the best Russian skaters play in the KHL, Russia's hockey league. But unlike the NHL, Russia's league is shutting down for the Winter Games. Now, it's tempting to draw parallels to the most exciting moment in American Olympic hockey, Lake Placid in 1980, when a bunch of American unknowns beat the mighty Soviets. Jordan Greenway was born 17 years after the Miracle on Ice.
What do I know? I mean, I've watched the movie Miracle like 100 times.
That's the 2004 Disney movie starring Kurt Russell. Solid movie, by the way. But could this be 1980 all over again? Two rivals colliding on the ice at a time of heightened tensions, with the Americans playing the role of scrappy underdogs? Again, editor Kevin Greenstein.
Maybe making a little too much into it in that Russian team that you're talking about in 1980 was one of the best teams ever. And the fact that the U.S. team was able to defeat them was extraordinary.
Mike Arruzioni scored the winning goal against the Soviet Union in 1980. He's now 63. He says sure he'd like to watch America's best players at the Olympics, but the guys on the ice, they can play too.
And it's still the Olympic Games, regardless of who's there. You still represent your country and you want to perform well, and I'm hoping this year's team goes over there and has a chance to win a medal.
He says you never know what'll happen. But does he see another Miracle on Ice in the making? Remember, 1980 was far bigger than just a hockey game.
I don't think it'll ever happen again. I think the scenario politically will never be the same with the threat of a Cold War and everything that was going on in our country. So I don't think you'll ever see anything like that again.
Yes, the planets aren't aligned like in 1980. But imagine this, a college kid who also happens to be the first black athlete to lace up the skates for Team USA, taking the winning shot against the heavily favored Olympic athletes from Russia. And all of this as investigations into Russian intervention in the 2016 presidential campaign unfold in Washington. That's not too shabby of a storyline. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
There's this ad from the 1960s for Michelin tires in France.
Le pneu Michelin X. Le pneu Michelin X. Le pneu Michelin X. Le pneu Michelin X.
It gets a little out of control. Now, you might know that Michelin also rates restaurants, and getting a Michelin star, better yet, two or three stars, is about as high praise as you can get in the restaurant business. But some chefs think this rating system has gotten out of control. In France, chef Sebastian Braun and his father Michel captured that highest of honors 18 years ago. Earlier this year, Braun decided he didn't want his three stars, and for the first time, the folks at Michelin agreed to take them back. Tim Weichman is a Boston-based chef who cut his teeth in French kitchens, including a three-starred one in Paris. He says it's not so surprising that Chef Bra wanted to be free.
With Michelin, there's a certain strictness to the list of things you have to execute at a certain level. And if you don't embrace that pathway for yourself, I could see how a chef would say, I want to be free. I want to do what I want.
So does a confinement come in trying to reach those three stars or any number of stars? Or does the confinement come in trying to maintain those stars?
It comes in both.
Yeah.
So first you have to follow – I don't know what Michelin inspectors do exactly, but there's a certain number of cheeses you'd have to have on your cheese board in France. or a certain level of service, and it's all in a discourse that is French. Michelin is global at this point,
right.
but just in France, I have experience with it. And they follow a specific regimen of what the culture and cuisine of France was and needs to be modernized, but just a little bit. It's very, very precise.
So give us a sense of how stressful it is working in a Michelin-starred restaurant, which you've done.
I was an apprentice, so I was at basically the lowest point, but it was always my dream to work in France because I'm a huge Francophile and I love that kind of food. But you wake up very early in the morning, and the really old-fashioned ones, you know, we would work close to 100 hours a week. Wow. Two services, 8 a.m., lunch was at 1, you get in at 8, and then break, clean up at 3 o'clock, and then back in the kitchen at 6, and you work till midnight again, 5 days a week.
And so what does it actually mean on the plate at the end of the day?
The plates have an incredibly large number of ingredients on them, and the precision to execute that requires a lot of chefs. And that's all part of the art form. It's almost like a Formula One team that jumps out at the car, and then 18 people are trying to take off the wheel all in like 5 seconds. At several restaurants I worked at, there was no less than 22 components on every dish.
Wow.
And then every dish in a 13-course tasting times 22 or 24 or whatever, you're talking about hundreds of factors that all have to happen in a short period of time. That's the pressure.
So as an apprentice in this Michelin-starred restaurant, was there a moment where you thought, wow, this task that I'm about to take on is just kind of crazy, where you kind of started to question, what is the value of these Michelin stars?
Yeah, you have to fully be open to saying that I'm going to learn this and I'm going to learn it this style. If you can't agree with that, it's not for you.
Yeah, what was that task where you kind of were scratching your head?
Oh, for me, it wasn't. I enjoyed it.
You did?
I enjoyed it. It's just and even when I had my own fine dining restaurant here in Boston, we don't have stars. I held myself to a Michelin standard. I created my own Michelin in my head.
I was wondering about that because you serve French-style cuisine in a restaurant not far from here in Cambridge. No stars, but you did win a lot of praise from critics. So how much were those Michelin stars kind of hanging above your whole mindset?
They were very much involved in creating that standard for myself.
Were you hoping for a Michelin star?
No. You know, as I got along, I realized it. I wouldn't even do it today. I wouldn't look for a Michelin star. I like the freedom more, and I wouldn't be able to keep up with those parameters. I wouldn't want to.
What do you think it's going to do to Chef Bras' business, getting rid of his stars?
I would think he would have to consider, you know, maybe doing less business, or he's not going to know.
But maybe he wants to slow down.
He could be a superstar on his own, or he could just – he's a great chef, so I think he'll be okay.
Chef Tim Weichmann, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Many immigrants in the United States have fled war, unrest, or natural disasters in their home countries. Here, they can apply for something called Temporary Protected Status, or TPS. It's allowed them to legally live and work in the U.S. But in recent months, the Trump administration has said it will terminate TPS for Nicaraguans, Haitians, and Salvadorans. And now another group is anxiously waiting. Some 6,000 Syrians will see their Temporary Protected Status expire in March if the government does not renew it. Amir Sina is a Syrian living in the U.S. under TPS. I spoke with him earlier today as we waited for word on that renewal question. Amir lives not far from us in Watertown, Massachusetts. And before I heard about his journey to the U.S., I asked for his reaction to Trump's speech last night, calling this a new American moment.
Well, the new American basically scares me, to be honest, because the way I think about America is a great nation for everyone. There is no discrimination at all. But the way it sounded, the new America is only for special people. I don't want to just repeat the cliche, make America white again. But I feel that's what's happening. I'm a little bit scared about what's the new America, because I think the old America is great. like America is always great. I didn't see like making America great again. I don't think that's accurate. It's a great nation. I've been here for 4 years. Honestly, everyone is welcoming. Everyone is warm. I see empathy from everyone.
So this goes straight into your own story, really. Why did you come here? Just walk us through the process of deciding to leave Syria and then actually arriving in the States.
So basically, I came from Lebanon. I didn't came from Syria. I did my undergrad in an American university in Beirut, and then I worked there for a couple of years till 2013. I got a visit visa. I was like really interested to come and like visit the U.S. So I came here in 2013. I did my tour. At the same time, I had the chance to do a presentation for the project I used to work on for MIT. And then because of like the bad situation in Syria and because like I have like also special situation that I cannot go back, I found that it's possible for me to apply for a TPS, temporary protected status.
So you arrived in 2013. Were you active at all in 2011 in the protests in Syria against Bashar al-Assad?
Yes. So I participated in some peaceful demonstrations against the corruption, against like the unfair election. I did that in Lebanon. I didn't do that in Syria. And also I did that in Copley in Boston.
So when were you granted temporary protected status here in the States?
So I got the temporary protected status in 2014, basically.
Okay. And did you understand from the beginning that TPS is, in fact, temporary, as the name suggests, and could end at any point?
I did. From its name, it's temporary protected status. It's just a program as long as there is a bad situation back home. The war is still there. There's missiles. There's explosions.
Mm. I mean, it's interesting because even though the United States has just committed to, you know, troops on the ground in Syria, there's this narrative circulating that the war is coming to an end. So if that's in the minds of people in Washington, what would you tell the U.S. government to help them understand where exactly the war is at?
So like basically it's like the war is all over the place in Syria. It's not – maybe it's more like concentrated in where the U.S. military. But also there are a lot of like execution. There are a lot of like killing from the regime still in Damascus in Syria where I'm from.
So what would it mean if TPS is revoked for Syrian nationals here in the U.S.?
I think it means like you are sending a lot of Syrians for death.
Really?
Yeah. It's really unsafe. Like you hosted people here like just for sheltering them for like a couple of years until like the war ends. But the war did not end. And really, like, I don't know who decide if the war ended or not. But, like, now, like, the media doesn't, like, focus much on, like, what's going on in Syria, like, day by day. But still, the situation is really bad.
What is it like to watch this war now entering its eighth year come March? What's it like to watch that from here in Boston?
Honestly, it's so frustrating. It's so scary. Like, people kind of, like, they managed. But at the end of the day, it's not, like, something that a human can have in their life.
So tell us what it would mean for you if TPS is extended.
So it's another hope for me. Basically, I did like a lot of investment here in the U.S. I worked really hard to be in my position now. So I work for an e-commerce based here in Boston, the company called Wayfair. Mm. I'm sure you heard about it. We sell furniture online.
Yes.
It's a great company. So I manage a team of four engineers now. Also, like after work, I go to school, so I'm about to graduate by the end of this year, maintaining a great GPA, 3.6.
Wow.
So, yeah, nice. I'm just like working really hard for my future. I just invested in a condo in Watertown.
You're living the dream.
Exactly. I'm just tired of like waiting for the war to end, and I want to like continue my life.
Where do you look for hope right now?
On CNN.
What are you finding there that gives you hope?
I just try to basically watch the news, try like I woke up, I run right away to CNN just to see if there is like any talk about the extension of this program, taking into consideration like I don't have like a big hope in this administration.
Are you networked with other Syrians who receive TPS around the country? And what is,
yes.
What is that conversation like?
It's basically like just like if they know anything about it. Like we were waiting for a decision yesterday. So I've been like on the news all the time, trying like just watching news, trying to see if the decision is out, but it's still not out yet. A lot of Syrians, they are like waiting and they are scared because a lot of them, they have only the TPS as their like status. So losing that meaning that they have to leave the country. And that's so dangerous for them, especially if they are like from like specific places in Syria.
If TPS is not extended, I mean, what would you do? Would you try and go underground? I mean, so deeply invested in this country now, it's kind of hard to imagine how you would actually pull that off.
Well, honestly, like, I don't have any – usually, like, I'm a software engineer. I always have plan B. But now, for me, it's really like I'm running out of solutions. I'm just trying to like, plan day by day. I always respect the law here. I don't want to go into illegal status, although sending me back to Syria means death for me because of my political opinion against the regime there.
Amr Sina, one of about 6,000 Syrians living in the U.S. under temporary protected status. Really, thank you a lot for coming in and sharing your story with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
That'll do it for us today here at The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.